Welcome to Broad Appeal, the podcast that looks back at female-driven films from the not-so-distant past. I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian.
How are you, Brian?
Well, Sean, it's a sunny day outside, and I am defiantly not celebrating the inherited monarchy of Great Britain. How are you?
Super as always. Also, same. Yeah, I'm from a republic, and vive la republique.
Yeah, the best way to fight against the pervasive royalist spectacle is to record a podcast about the unification of Europa.
Exactly, yeah.
Exactly right.
Yeah, our bull is on its way.
It has to be said, Sean, it is a sunny, sunny, sunny day outside. Summer is here. You and I are here in the studio for one last time for a little while. This is going to be the conclusion of our Good, Bad, Crazy series. Did you ever think
it would be this long? No, it didn't, actually. But, hey, best laid plans. What's the rest of stuff saying?
The best laid plans of mice and men often go awry.
Is that it? You're making this up.
No, of mice and men, John Steinbeck.
I've read it, studied in school.
Well, there are some mice that appear in the film we're going to talk about today, but before we get to that...
before we get to the mice.
Before we get to those little critters, I thought it might be nice for a moment to reflect on this series. We've had a lot of new listeners and new subscribers who have come to us from Good, Bad, Crazy. Has it been everything you hoped it would be?
It's been really enjoyable, I have to say, even though it's a lot of hard work. You know, for those of you who are listening at home, watching three films and recording three podcasts, and in Brian's case, editing three podcasts, does take up a lot of time.
I now know how Krzysztof Kieslowski felt, you know?
With bi-weekly trilogy.
Everything a trilogy, yeah. Or a decalogue, yeah. But, you know, there has been something really fun about the, like, prismatic approach to looking at actresses through these three different lenses. I feel like all the actresses that we've covered in the Good, Bad, Crazy, I really understand them in a really different way.
Yeah, and actually, you know, this was not an insulting series at all. You know, very often we've realized that what constitutes a bad film is not necessarily the actor's fault. And crazy can mean a whole lot of brilliant things. What have been the best crazy films we've done this series, do you think?
Well, I have to say, I have a really newfound appreciation for some people that I didn't even know I loved, like Jennifer Lopez. Yeah. You might scoff that we included Jennifer Lopez in the Pantheon, but like all of those films were really interesting, especially The Boy Next Door, which has to be one of my crazy faves. It was really fun to revisit Glenda Jackson, of course, yeah, the other week. Do you remember our Michelle Pfeiffer episode that started us off? I mean, Fabulous Baker Boys is nearly a perfect film.
Angela Bassett was probably my favorite one.
Yeah, because you really love Discovering Strange Days.
This is for me, yeah. Discovering Strange Days was by far the highlight of this podcast series.
I would have said that we've also probably seen some of the worst movies that we've ever seen. I would have said Nuts was the worst at one point. Then I would have said Eat, Pray, Love was possibly the worst. But I think we may have topped it with the one that is coming up to conclude the bad.
Yes, but as you know, listeners, this episode is about Juliette Binoche, and we have a real trio of films for you. But the bad one, my God, is it. Is it bad?
It is movies.
Yeah.
Well, okay, we're going to get to Juliette Binoche, but you know, Sean, the fans have been asking. They've been saying news of the hiatus has been spreading along the Rialto, and they've all been saying to us, will you be coming back with Good, Bad, Crazy? And what is the answer?
The answer is, we don't know.
Nous ne savons pas.
No. What we do know is that we need a break.
We need a break. We need some vitamin D.
We need a holiday.
Yeah.
We need a holiday.
That's true. What are we going to be doing in our summer break while we are not recording new episodes of the podcast?
Well, just as well that we're taking a break, because you and I, committed life partners that we are, are going to not see much of each other for the next couple of months, are we?
No, I will be somewhere and you will be somewhere else for a long stretch of time. Anybody who happens to be near Worcester, Massachusetts, that's where I'm going to be doing a writing fellowship at the American Antiquarian Society, researching a new play that I'm hoping to write, set during the War of 1812. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, you heard that right.
Do not adjust your ham radios.
What about you, Sean? What are you going to be doing?
I'm going to be visiting various cities across the UK, such as Corby, Skegness, Peterborough, all the places that are definitely on a map somewhere.
All our listeners in Tallinn can look for you when you're in Estonia.
Yeah, I'll be going to Tallinn for work as well, for a wonderful Baltics project with young illustrators. And then I get to enjoy a month in this apartment without you.
You're also going to be watching a lot of short films, am I right?
I am helping in terms of pre-selection for the London Film Festival for their short film programs. So that is quite a big deal for me. And then, Brian, can we talk about the highlight of the summer, please?
Yes, go ahead.
The highlight of the summer is that we are going to Provincetown, Massachusetts for our holiday.
Yes, we will be reunified after our separation by reconvening on the beach at P-Town with our beneficent benefactor, listener Scott Hoffer, who is also the person who provided us with these microphones.
Yes, and his delightful boyfriend, Justin Farkas, who, if you need any quality high fashion photograph taken, he's your man. Or some wood chops.
Woodworking, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Scott Hoffa.
So I have
say
to
it again.
Say, it's Scott Hoffa.
One more time.
No. Sean, there are a whole bunch of people who tuned into this because they thought they were going to hear about Juliette Binoche, and they've just basically heard us reading our diaries, okay? So don't worry. It's now time for JB. We are here in London on a day in which Anglophilia is ascendant. Meghan Markle, American actress, is joining that family of inbred aristocrats. And yet we are defiantly flying the flag of the European Union.
Yes.
Is this appropriate?
It is very true. Sidebar, do you know what her new title is?
Is she the Duchess of Sussex?
Very good, yeah. I thought, you know, Sussex, because Sussex is crazy and left-wing in England, you know, with Brighton and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So maybe they thought, she's young, she's hip, let's give her Sussex.
Well, we shouldn't totally disparage Prince Harry and now Duchess Meghan. As far as I can tell, they've done a lot of good work and have asked for donations and their name to be given to various charities fighting the HIV/AIDS epidemic, so
yeah.
Good for them.
Yeah, Harry's not a bad one, you know.
Well, he is also a militaristic, jingoistic killer.
Yes, of course, yes.
But, you know, putting that aside.
Putting that aside.
I mean, we don't want geopolitics to dominate this discussion, but
it has to.
It
in
has
this episode.
To. Because we're in a moment when, you know, questions of unity with Europe and Europeanness are all very fraught matters, and you and I very much wanted to include an actress who performs most of the time not in English. That actress, of course, is Juliette Binoche. Do you pronounce it Binoche or Binoche? I know different people do different things.
Juliette Binoche. No, I say Juliette Binoche. I'd probably say Juliette Binoche, actually.
Juliette?
Yeah.
Mm.
That's correct, isn't it?
Well, I would say it's like Juliette.
Juliette Binoche. Do you say Isabel Huppert?
On the money with that one. Yeah. Yes, John. So Juliette Binoche, to me, is an actress that I have always had an affection for. The films that we're going to cover today, actually, I saw most of them when they came out, if not in the cinema, certainly on VHS or DVD soon afterwards. But it is really only over time that I think I've come to appreciate Juliette Binoche. Not to belabor, you know, certain French stereotypes, but I do think that in many ways, the long, long career of Juliette Binoche has to be likened to a fine wine.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Bear with me here. So you see this young woman appearing in French art house fair. She has an enigmatic, beautiful expression. She's clearly recognized by auteurs like Jean-Luc Godard and Louis Malle and Philip Kaufman in The Unbearable Lightness of Being. And her roles, when she's very young, are often sexualized and beautiful and delicate and mysterious, right? And you think, okay, I've put her in that box. But over time, just like a wine, she has matured, she's ripened, we've discovered all sorts of different notes in her career, and I'm not quite sure at what point I really said, okay, I don't just like Juliette Binoche, but I really love her. It was somewhere as she was passing through middle age that I just really realized, in many ways, Juliette Binoche is like the actress's actress. Mm-hmm. And I think for you and me, there are certain people that we put like way, way up. Julianne Moore. Sorry, that was a bit French accented. But Julianne Moore, Isabelle Huppert. You and I have like praised both of them exponentially. But when you just look at the pure facts, I actually think Juliette Binoche may be our most indispensable, adventurous, and artistically diverse actress.
Yeah, and not on like a bottle of wine. You know, you walk down to your cav and you look around and you think, oh my god, I totally forgot this was here. That's amazing.
Yeah, the Horseman on the Roof? What an excellent vintage. Oh, The Widow of Saint-Pierre? Marvelous.
Yeah.
I'm just mentioning a bunch of Juliette Binoche movies that I've seen that no one else remembers.
Yeah, bracky. Anyway, as you said, there's a startling amount of auteurist directors that she has worked with and is continuing to work with. I mean, you mentioned Louis Malle, Jean-Luc Godard. We could also say people like Michael Haneke, Claire Denis.
Abbas Kiarostami.
Yeah, absolutely. And even, you know, the director of Godzilla, whoever that is.
Gareth Edwards, I believe. You liked Godzilla, didn't you?
I did like Godzilla. It had one of the worst scripts ever. And as is standard, the white man and his wife are the most fucking boring characters in the world.
Which is her and Bryan Cranston.
No, not at all.
Oh.
No, she dies in a nuclear accident.
Oh. She doesn't get stomped by the dinosaur, or whatever he is. Not a dinosaur.
Oh my god.
What is Godzilla?
Godzilla is a, you know,
nuclear lizard.
Nuclear lizard, yeah. No, it's that guy, Sam Taylor Johnson. Aaron Taylor Johnson.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, who has lovely arms, but really, I mean, that role didn't give him many opportunities. But there is this great scene of Juliet being trapped behind nuclear security doors and perishing.
Into the Silkwoods.
Yeah, she's great. She's so good. Of course she's in Godzilla.
I think we're you know, burying the lead a bit. We're talking about auteurs that she's worked with, and most of the time we've been talking about Godzilla, because, like, actually, like, she's this beautiful demoiselle. You kind of can see that she's the type of person who a certain kind of possibly misogynist kind of French European director, you know, might be thinking, the perfect woman to project all my fantasies onto, you know, and like in a movie like Damage, which we have a previous episode, yeah.
Oh, yes.
You know, she is definitely the mysterious femme fatale. She's defined by sexuality. But then somewhere along the way, she just started, well, she went through her Hollywood phase. Of course, she won her Academy Award for The English Patient. She's the soul of the film. I haven't seen it in many years. Like, it's definitely prestige filmmaking of the kind that's on the border of commercial and the border of art, you know?
How much of the film is she in?
Well, it's like a frame story, yeah? Ralph Fiennes is the English patient who's been shot down and burned, and he's suffering from horrible burns, and she's the nurse who's tending to him. The main plot line is the story that he tells her of his time in the desert.
Oh, so he can speak?
Yes. But actually, if you read the novel of The English Patient, her plot line is much bigger in the novel, but she's so memorable in the movie. And of course, most memorable of all is her Oscar win, which was a real surprise. Didn't she beat Barbara Hershey for Portrait of a Lady?
Yeah, she also beat Marion Jean-Baptiste.
In Secrets and Lies. And of course, famously, she beat Lauren.
Yeah, I thought Lauren was going to get it. And I think she deserves it. Where are you?
Where are you? I think we all tried our best on this film, and Anthony was there to help us. I'm so amazed. This is a dream. It must be a French dream, I think. Bye.
I have to say, like, I don't think it was particularly tactful that she kind of called out Lauren Bacall in particular in that Oscar speech.
Well, listen, in Juliet's defense, okay, she was so unprepared.
I'm amazed.
Like, there are certain instances where people are like, oh my god, I didn't think it's going to happen. And they could take out a speech of their bra, you know, yeah, what I mean? A Leporello length speech. But in her case, it's like, she did not believe it, okay? Do you remember what she was wearing?
She's wearing like a kind of strange architectural gown that has like a sort of weird collar, like cape-like thing. Am I right?
Yeah, I call it her bearded dragon dress.
Well, you and I have watched that clip often enough that I ought to remember.
It's probably my favorite Oscar win. And it's so natural. By natural, I mean it is literally words coming out of her mouth.
Yeah, and I guess you could feel more aggrieved if this like upstart French woman who beat her had turned out not to be one of our greatest living actresses. But how extraordinary is it that Juliette Binoche has an Oscar and got it in 1996?
It would be
the films of 96, I think.
Yeah, that is great because it's so long ago, and in many ways, it is so insignificant to the films that have come thereafter.
I think the fact that we can say Academy Award winner Juliette Binoche has had a big impact on her career, though.
Yeah.
Certainly, she wouldn't have gone through that weird middle period where she did English language films, one of which we will be talking about soon, have no fear.
Yeah.
Maybe she was lured by the siren song of money and Hollywood fame, but then at a certain point she clearly said, back to Europe, back to working with directors who are really going to push me. And I think it's that turn. Like, okay, I liked Juliette so much in The English Patient, but I kind of thought, okay, she's always going to play this very warm, very generous-hearted person who says things like, the heart is an organ of fire. The heart is an organ of fire. I love that. I believe that. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful performance. But when that is like your definitive Oscar clip, like, it is a bit insipid. And you kind of think, if she had been stuck playing kind of like all lovely French women speaking in that voice all the time, like, you just would have wanted to slap her.
I think part of the reason why she probably got that award was because she carved out enough of a filmography in which she was aloof, distant, cold, chilly. I mean, come on, Anna Barden.
Yeah, but darling, I don't think most Academy voters had seen the majority of her filmography. Like, if they're nominating The Mirror Has Two Faces, I doubt that they've seen, like, Jean-Luc Godard's Je Vous Salue Marie. You know what I mean? Like, maybe some of them had.
Why do we give so little credit to these people who actually are in the film industry and decide these things? It's as if they have seen nothing.
But they're in the American film industry, that's the thing. And so when a European can break through the Oscars, like Catherine Deneuve, I believe, only has one Oscar nomination. Yep. Isabelle Huppert has only one Oscar nomination. Juliette has two.
Yeah, but Marianne Cotillard has two.
Yeah, and an Oscar. Yeah. Win, of course. Yeah. No, there are certain people who are kind of international stars of a certain caliber. And like Marianne Cotillard has been another one who has like actually impressed me so much more since her Oscar win.
Yeah.
We've mentioned Isabelle Huppert. I think right now she's experiencing a moment kind of driven by like internet memes and stuff, certainly around the time of Elle,
yeah,
where all of our gay Twitter fanboys kind of just go gaga for Isabelle. Now, we fucking love Isabelle. You should listen to us effuse about Elle in our past Oscar episode and her role in The Piano Teacher. In an Isabelle versus Juliette cage match of actressing, who do you think holds the upper hand? Is that even a fair question?
Well, I mean, I think to the untrained eye, you may say Isabelle Huppert, you know, can hold her in a headlock. Because Isabelle,
she's quite a petite woman.
Yeah, doesn't matter, babe. I'm pretty small and I can kick anyone's ass. But the thing is,
don't I know it?
Don't you know it? The thing is, yes, you know, Isabelle Huppert has things like The Piano Teacher and Elle, which are these very kind of extreme films where, like, she is pushed to the limits of good taste and what an actress is expected to do on screen and all the kind of stuff. These French actresses have these really long filmographies, you know, which is full of, like, a lot of small little things that, yeah, are very European, but don't exactly all have the same mouth of teeth.
That's all very interesting what you've said, but you've not defined who you think is better.
I would have said, until I consulted Wikipedia, I would have said Isabelle Huppert had the meatier filmography. However, you look at Juliette Binoche, and you look and you see when she started out, and all those early kind of spooky weird films, you know, with
Leo Carax.
Yeah, and with Godard. And then, like you said, the English Patient era, we could call it. And then now, as a middle-aged woman who is stunning, gorgeous, you know,
but political.
But doing theater, doing Antigone in the Barbican,
dancing with Akram Khan.
Yeah, like all these things. You know what I mean? It may be actually she is the greatest living actress.
Sacrilege.
Well, maybe it's true. I mean, like, have her and Julianne Moore ever been in a film together?
No.
Well, I think
they get along. I can imagine the two of them being in a movie and getting along. I cannot literally imagine what it would be like if Isabelle Huppert and Juliette Binoche, like, ran into each other at the Boulangerie.
Or the steps of the Palais. Yeah.
Yeah.
They have. They must have.
I don't know why. I mean, I don't want to, you know...
It's like Cher and Madonna bumping into each other, isn't it?
I don't want to construct, like, a sexist...
Yeah, I
know. ...cat fight. But it's just hard to imagine the two of them talking to each other. Like, I feel like it would be similar to that moment in The Devil Wears Prada where Miranda Priestly... What does she say when she runs into that French lady?
Jacqueline, que belle surprise. Oui, c'est moi.
Isabelle, ah ouais. You know, and I feel that the chilliness would probably mostly come from Isabelle because she doesn't suffer fools gladly.
No, she does not. The only time I ever sit in the front rows of a cinema is during a film festival where there's a Q&A because I don't take photos, okay? But I do want to look, I want to elevate all of them on stage, up and down, okay? Mm-hmm. And Isabelle was there wearing a coat, which she just drops to the floor, okay? And she does this little thing where she, like, puts one foot in front of the other and just stands there. And when people are like, were you intimidated by this role that you were doing in Elle? Like, was it a challenge? And she was like, no, well, I did the piano teacher and, you know, this is my thing. And that's it. And she says it with a kind of, like, it's almost like she's winking, saying, I'm Isabelle Huppert.
And also, like, you're an idiot for asking me the question. Whereas I feel like Juliette Binoche would be much more effusive in a certain way.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to paint Juliette Binoche as if she's not an intellectual.
No. Absolutely. I don't think you are.
But she's just got this, like, down-to-earth quality.
She's got this kind of Beau Soleil interior, don't you think?
Yes, for instance. That actually, of course, many of you... Well, no, not many of you. Some of you may have seen her latest film, The Claire Denis, which was released under the English title Let the Sunshine In.
Boring.
The title or the film?
The title, honestly.
Yeah, it's boring.
I would have liked to have seen On the Underground a bright internal sun, okay? That's what I would have liked to have seen.
Eternal sunshine of the bright inside me.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, like, both Isabelle and Juliette with some of their recent films have reached this point that French people do so well and English-speaking filmmakers just have not understood, which is the middle-aged, sexually active woman movie. So you have Isabelle in L'Avenir, which is maybe my favorite Isabelle performance. Like, Julia is doing something very similar in Let the Sunshine In her own Juliet register.
Yeah, yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It is nothing like Isabelle Huppert at all.
Yeah, and I can totally understand why some people would not like Let the Sunshine In, because it's kind of a weird postmodern deconstructed rom-com. Do you know actually what Claire Denis claims it's based on? She claims it's inspired by a book by Roland Barthes. Which I think is actually probably accurate. In this movie, which I've now seen twice and Sean's seen part of.
I fell asleep during it.
He was a
not because
tired.
I was bored, but because I was very tired.
Yeah, and to be honest, it is mostly like lots of really dreadful men kind of being boorish and self-interested and stupid. And poor Juliette, in close-up, filmed by Claire Denis, kind of looking at them like, oh my god, do I really have to listen to all this bullshit just so that I can get stupped? And I think what I love about...
we've been there.
What I love about her characterization in that movie is, like, she's just messy and emotional and kind of sometimes together and sometimes vulnerable. She's an older woman, but she still looks stunning, but she's kind of wearing clothes that are probably a little bit not the right things to be wearing, like those high-heeled leather boots and stuff.
No, but she's wearing those because that is the plumage of heterosexual attraction, darling.
Yeah, but what I love about her performance in that film is, like, you can see how she feels restricted by having to wear all that clothing, but she still goes about and does it. Like, she both loves and hates the dance of trying to, like, get men into her bed and, like, hates the fact that she needs them and can't feel independent. Like, she plays all that ambiguity really, really well. The movie itself is a bit weird. I kind of love the way its narrative structure, like, takes romantic comedy tropes and, like, turns them on their head, or, like, doesn't even allow them to complete themselves. It's a good one for a lover of Juliet to watch, but not if you're kind of looking for, you know, the French equivalent of, like, 27 Dresses. So we're going to get to Trois Couleurs Bleues in just a moment, but I think, can each of us go down to the wine cellar of Juliette Binoche's career and pick, if we had to pick one single, un seul bouteille de vin, right? We have to pick one bottle, one vintage, to kind of show what we love about Juliette. What would it be?
You go first. No, I'll go first, because you were talking for ages. It would be, without hesitation, it would be The Clouds of Sils Maria for me.
Mm.
Yeah.
I can smell the bouquet now. It is full-bodied.
It's very full-bodied, okay? Yes. It has the It has the consistency of blood, which I like. It has this kind of great mouthfeel, really stains your teeth, okay? Very kind of plummy notes, but with a nice little bit of acidity that just makes the back of your tongue, you know, clench. You know that taste?
This metaphor, darling, is as long as my career. can we get to talking about what you actually like about Clouds of Sils Maria?
Okay, so this was the first Olivier Assayas film that I've seen. I also saw it in a very memorable circumstance where I was in... Where was I?
The IFC Center in the West Village.
Yeah, which was great, you know, which is lovely to go there. I came out of the film being like... Brian, I don't know. Am I Maria Enders? Am I Valentine? I just don't know.
For those who haven't seen The Clouds of Sils Maria, there are some listening to this, like, what is it about and why do you love it so much?
It's a little all about Eve meets, like, European soap opera meets, like, actress sexual Ophelia.
With sapphic overtones.
With sapphic overtones. And it also, like, very kind of tongue-in-cheek metal quality. So basically, in the film, Juliette Binoche plays an aging actress called Maria Enders. Is there with her assistant, Valentine, who is played by Kristen Stewart. And the whole crux of the film is that Maria Enders is playing the leading role in the play that made her a star. Except this time around, she is playing the role of the older woman. And a new ingenue, played by Chloe Grace Moretz, she plays the younger Eve Harrington role.
And so it's all this kind of, like, duality, right?
Yeah.
Of, like, the older woman and the younger woman in the play, but also, like, the older and younger woman of Juliette and Kristen, who's her personal assistant.
Yeah, because the interesting, it's not about the rivalry between, like, the old actress and the younger actress. That happens on stage kind of through the words. But it's more like the kind of the rivalry between the friendship and slash professional working relationship she has with this young woman and their codependency together. And it is just really very funny.
There's also some skinny dipping.
There's hairstyles, everything. You know? There's also a fake movie where Chloe Grace Moretz is, like, in space, and it is great. Okay, I love when movies do that.
You're actually really making me want to watch Clouds of Sils Maria again right now.
Yeah, I would love it. So her character is called Maria Enders, and afterwards I was like, Brian, why didn't they call her Maria Sils? And that would have just been, like, really clever.
It has to also be said, Juliette, despite being advanced in her years for an actress, she goes full starkers, full naked in that skinny dipping scene.
Yeah, well, K2 does not.
K2 does not. She keeps her bra on. My pick, which I won't dwell too long on, but I want to turn all listeners onto, is a much less recognized Juliette Binoche performance. She doesn't appear nude, except emotionally, in the film Flight of the Red Balloon by the Chinese auteur Hu Hsiao-hsien. Have you heard me talk about this virtually every week for the last 5 years?
Yeah, it's one of those things, like Mad Men, that I will eventually acquiesce to watch.
Yeah, but there's a certain kind of Brian movie, yeah, in which nothing happens except for delicately observed long takes of things, which I watch by myself when no one else is around, and then I tell everyone that they're, like, wonderful movies. It's most of the filmography of Apichapong Wirasatakun, and it's also Flight of the Red Balloon. So the movie is an Asian filmmaker making an homage to a classic French film of childhood. But the central performance is Juliette Binoche as the mother of this young boy who is kind of roaming through the streets of Paris, and the mother is kind of a mess. She's this, like, single mother. Do you know what her profession is in Flight of the Red Balloon?
Oh, she's a photographer or something.
No, she runs a marionette theater. So she's like kind of this woman who sort of, her life is a mess. She has this like spiky blonde hair. She's divorced.
I did not see her as blonde.
Well, she's great in this. She's like divorced. She's trying to take care of her son while also dealing with her like own complicated emotional life and her resentments of her husband and all this kind of stuff. We see her running her marionette theater with all these like Japanese kind of bunraku puppets and all this stuff. There's an incredible scene where there's a piano that's being moved up a set of stairs while she's having like an emotional breakdown in her apartment. I basically have not told you anything about anything that actually happens in the film, but is just so finely observed. And I think it is the first time that I saw Juliette Binoche in something and I was like, wow, she can be spiky, somewhat unlikable, but still sympathetic and mature into middle age in a way that feels really real and really lived in. And I think she's been existing in that space in all her recent work, the ones we've just mentioned. So this all brings us to Juliette Binoche, The Good, one of her earliest and most iconic roles was in Krzysztof Kieslowski's trilogy, the Trois Couleurs trilogy. She plays Julie, the lead actress in Bleu.
And now, Brian, these films fascinated me for years, long before I've seen them. And actually, this is the first time I've seen Blue. I had studied Red previously, and I watched White off my own accord. One of the best things about having a university library and being a film studies student. Like, all the films that were there on DVD were just great, you know? I rented Salo several times, but never watched it.
Well, I have to say, the Three Colors trilogy holds a special place in my heart as well, which is like the birth of my snobbery. We've talked a lot about how, as a high school student, I kind of always had tastes that were like beyond my station, so to speak. So I certainly had watched probably Merchant Ivory films. Actually, maybe I hadn't, because probably the first Merchant Ivory was around the same time when I saw Howard's End. It was around the same years. Yeah, I'm sure I'd seen French language films before, but most of them maybe were like the movies that we were asked to watch in French class. Like, I'm sure we saw Au revoir les enfants and things like that. I'd seen films with subtitles, but they were kind of commercial things like Cinema Paradiso, you know, heartwarming. But I remember from my weekly viewing of Siskel and Ebert at the movies, every once in a while they would recommend something. And when they started talking about this movie series, The Three Colors, which were inspired by the French values of liberté, égalité, and fraternité, I thought to myself, I've got to go see these movies. And listener Scott Hoffer and I, who has already been name-checked in this podcast, we were like the two lone people in our high school class who, like, you know, asked about our favorite films. We'd be like, well, of course, the Three Colors trilogy. Oh my God, they were completely overlooked at the Oscars this year. Absolutely preposterous. Our real affection was for Trois Couleurs Rouges, which I have seen, I'm not kidding, like dozens of times.
Yeah, and the reason why I studied that in university was because our professor, Tony Fitzmaurice, said that it was the best one.
I don't know if it's the best one. In some ways, it might be regarded as the most sentimental one. I've seen Red many, many times. I think I probably first saw it in the cinema somewhere in Greater Boston. And then I remember I actually sought out the other two in reverse order because I think they'd already been released. So I eventually saw White, which is Julie Delpy and Zbigniew Ziemiatkowski and focuses on relations between Poland and Western Europe. And I eventually finally saw Blue, but I'm pretty sure that I had only seen Blue the one time before we rewatched it the other night for the pod. Now, Sean, I've already mentioned Liberty, Equality, and Fraternity, but, like, what is the whole project of the Three Colors trilogy? Like, why was it coming out in the early 90s? What was Kieslowski's vision, as you understand it?
You know, when we look at Europe today, we see a troubled continent of 27 EU member states. You jump back almost 30 years to just near enough when I was being born, you realize that what we consider to be Western Europe was much smaller than it is, and that Germany was not whole. I always say to myself, you know what, Sean, you're actually not that old. I say that to myself every half hour.
Maria Enders.
But I say to myself, you know, 10 years ago I was in school, basically, okay? And I think to myself that is so little time ago. The 18 years before that, I was born. And at that point, Europe was still a communist and capitalist continent, East versus West, Iron Curtain, the Berlin Wall. The idea of German reunification was a dream.
Well, and they also had completely divergent economies,
yes,
and currencies.
Yeah, everything. Like, you know, we're living in troubled times, but so much has happened in these, you know, 30 short years that when you look back at the impetus for the creation of these three films, my mind kind of boggles, because it's like, wow, such monumental changes were happening in Europe. And so, like you said, these films are in many ways ultimately about the reunification of Europe, but also the unity, the introduction, as it were, between East and West, and the partnerships that were forged therein.
And I think also Kieslowski, while they have elements of sentimentality and hopefulness, all three of the films have ironizing and complications to all the concepts that the films are based on. They're also aesthetically truly beautiful, right? So that the way that the title colors of red, white, and blue appear symbolically throughout each of the films is really, really stunning, just on a purely visual level.
I would also say that the European Union, the European project, is itself at its core sentimental and hopeful.
It is, and I think maybe some of that idealism and that hopefulness over the last 30 years has led to productive progress, and then other things, you know, have revealed the fractures and the fissures that still exist. And I'm not just talking about Brexit, but also like the rising of nationalism all throughout the Union, and particularly,
yeah,
you know, in the kind of
in Hungary,
the,
yeah,
East, you know, and the way in which Europe still defines itself against outsiders with the refugee crisis and all of that. Kieslowski, of course, was Polish, so he had an interesting perspective on this. Even before doing Three Colors, he'd done La Double Vie de Véronique,
yeah,
which takes the same actress and presents her as Véronique, a French woman, and Veronica, a mm-hmm. Polish woman, so he was really into this East-West thing.
Yeah, not to mention Decalogue, which is about the Ten Commandments.
In each episode, yeah, of that is inspired by the Ten Commandments. The man loved a series. He really loved a schematic or a thematic construct, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I'm sure there's some like really highfalutin film scholars who say, well, when you announce that your movie is based on three colors and three themes, it's kind of like providing the most obvious frames of interpretation. And that may be why I, as a high schooler, you know, thought they were so cool and sophisticated.
Yeah, I agree. But you know, you don't have to make things too esoteric in order to build something quite stunning and thoughtful around them.
Sure.
You know, other film deals with the conflict between East and West and our own past histories.
I feel like you're gonna say Showgirls.
No,
what?
Anna, starring Sally Kirkland.
All the way back in 1987.
Yeah, which we haven't seen, and I guarantee that film will appear on this podcast.
With God as my witness, yeah, I will surely see Anna again. All right, so Trois Couleurs Bleues. The theme is liberty. It is that classic French virtue, liberty leading the people. You know that painting, right? She's got the flag.
Yeah, of course
I do.
She's
got one breast hanging out. Yeah.
Of course I do.
So the concept of liberté, it feels like, well, it's basically liberty. I think Kieslowski really complicates what liberty means. In all three of these films, the story and the protagonist that he chooses to focus on are maybe not the most obvious people that you would expect given the theme. So in what ways is Three Colors Blue a film about liberty? Who is the person who is being liberated? And how?
The person in question is Julie, who's played by Juliette Binoche. And by liberty, it means that the setting and the security and the life that she had, which was wife and mother, suddenly end. And so liberty in this case is determined by the ending of something and not necessarily from the freedom of something.
Yeah, I mean, she is completely unmoored. The life that she had been, you know, safely ensconced in, even if she had dissatisfactions, is suddenly ripped from her. Because, like, I don't know, you would think if I told you, like, make a story about liberty, maybe you'd think, oh, a prisoner, you know, getting out and having to deal with that kind of freedom. In some ways, I suppose, Julie has been a kind of prisoner or someone who has had something repressed, or I don't know, but due to a freak chance accident in which her husband and her daughter are killed and she survives, she has to deal with the kind of emotional wreckage of all that, of her past, and also the new freedom of being alone in the world and dealing with the, quote, new world order that she has to face. I mean, the more actually we talk about this, the more I'm thinking, like, so much of the world, and particularly Europe, I guess, had been defined by this Cold War mentality that suddenly was gone. All the structures that had bound Europe and the West seemed like they were gone, and what were the new structures that were going to replace them? That can feel liberating. It can also feel scary and disorienting. And I think that's part of the genius of the premise of this film.
Yeah, because as we all know, when communism ended and the Soviet Union crumbled, I mean, in the case of a lot of people who were living in extreme poverty and, you know, who didn't have access to basic facilities, including food and medicine and everything like that, capitalism, Western capitalism, kind of freed them from that to some degree. But there were, of course, there were people, as we all know, in these societies who were quite comfortable, you know, who lived very middle class lives, even in the GDR, you know, people lived middle class lives.
Sure. And I mean, a movie like White deals with the kind of communist question much more explicitly. Like, Julie, our protagonist in this film, she never mentions communism or nationhood in any way, but the kind of thematic link has something to do with her husband, yeah, his profession and the work that he's been involved in just before he's killed. So who is he?
Well, he is a very famous and well-respected composer, and he was in the process of composing a piece for the European reunification. A great concerto to usher in this new era of continental harmony.
And harmony is interesting because it's about, you know, voices coming together. And we learn a bit over the course of the movie of what was planned for this masterwork, right? It's going to be performed simultaneously in 12 different cities by 12 different orchestras and choirs. The chorus is in Greek. And it's using the words from the Gospels, you know, St. Paul, love is patient, love is kind, and all this kind of develops slowly over the course of the film. We eventually hear longer and longer portions of this piece of music, which actually is a really stunning piece of music on its own, not actually written by the fictional dead husband, but by the great composer, Zbigniew Preisner, who you loved one of his previous scores that we dealt with on Broad Appeal.
Yeah, he did a score for Damage, which I'm going to listen to as soon as this recording is over.
And he did all the scores for all of the Kieslowski films. He is absolutely amazing. I don't know what's happened to this big new prize.
Does he compose for any Milms anymore, no?
He composers for Milms.
That's not staying in, is it?
I don't know. No. What's ever happened to Zbigniew Preisner?
I don't know.
Where in the world is he?
I hope he's alive.
Yeah, well, he certainly gave us some wonderful tunes.
Milne.
Okay, so we get very little of Julie and her family life before the wreckage, right? We just actually see them driving in a car on the French countryside. Her young daughter is holding her hand out the window, and there's like a candy wrapper that she's flapping in the air, and it's actually blue, the first of many significant objets in the film that are blue. We see a young boy on the side of the road who's playing with a little toy. He's one of those ones where you try to get the
ball into the
little cup or the stick or something. You know, it's pure chance, right? Will the ball land on the stick? Well, in this case, it does, just as the car that they're driving crashes into a tree.
Yeah.
Julie survives. We kind of learn piecemeal a bit about her and her husband and their life together and some of the secrets that maybe have been uncovered. Do you want to just give us, like, the bare bones of what some of those discoveries and secrets are?
What we do learn is that this marriage wasn't exactly the most loving, you know, harmonious one in the world, and that actually, for starters, her husband was having an affair and actually had fathered a yet unborn child with another woman.
And it's not clear that Julie even knows about this, but she kind of learns it through uncovering his papers and sees pictures of him with this woman, and then the pregnancy is a sort of very late reveal in the film. There's also what seems like a kind of open secret or rumor circulating about the husband's music.
Yeah, the open secret is that, not unlike paperback novelist Dick Francis, that his wife actually wrote all the music, that Julie herself wrote the music.
I didn't know this. Dick Francis, Mrs. Dick was the actual
Mrs.
author.
Mrs. Francis.
Really?
Well, this is what my mother says.
Does she have any evidence?
She says, you know, after his wife died, the novels just started getting really bad.
Well, I don't want to be sued for libel on podcast show.
Well, my mother says allegedly that after his wife died, the novels just became, you know, really bad.
You know, when Woodrow Wilson got into a coma and lived for like a year and a half, and the first lady, Mrs. Wilson, would like sign his name to things.
Wow, like, executive orders.
Executive orders and stuff like that. She basically ran things.
That's amazing.
And
what decade is this?
This is in like the 1920s. This is why that amendment about the incapacity of the president came to pass.
Well, can you imagine Melania signing things?
Whew. Let's not go down that road.
Yeah. But,
so as Julie is dealing with grief, we see her quite traumatized and shell-shocked in the hospital. I mean, some of the first scenes we see, we have this close-up of Juliette Binoche's iris, intense close-up of her eye. She's in the hospital. She has a neck brace. She survives. She learns that her husband and her daughter are both dead. She then watches their immensely grandiose state funeral on the television while she's still in the hospital.
Nous sommes réunis ici aujourd'hui pour honorer la mémoire d'un homme et d'un compositeur que le monde entier reconnaît comme l'un des plus grands. Nul ne peut accepter qu'il soit absent. Et nous pensons aussi à cette petite fille de 5 ans qui l'a accompagnée dans la mort. Patrice, des millions d'hommes et de femmes attendaient cette musique que tu avais composée pour cette grande fête de l'Europe que nous l'espérons tous, nous pourrons célébrer bientôt.
Her first move seems to be that she thinks I ought to commit suicide as well. How can I... Mm-hmm. How can I survive? Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, there's this great scene where she, you know, she breaks a window as a distraction in order to get into the nurse's office, and then opens up a whole bottle of pills and puts them in her mouth. And you can see this moment in her face. It's like, what am I going to do? And she spits them out just as the nurse comes in. And Juliet says, I'm sorry, my husband and daughter just died.
Yeah, and the nurse is very sympathetic.
Yeah,
to that.
That's a great scene.
And this is like the very start of the film.
Yeah.
Like,
actually, what I said to you was, my God, isn't film gorgeous?
Well, and isn't this woman gorgeous? I mean, Juliette Binoche had obviously been a major actress before this point. I think she'd already been nominated for 2 César Awards. She'd done Damage. She'd done the Unbearable Lightness of Being. But there's something about, while still a very young woman and still being extremely beautiful in this film, she has a spine of steel and strength and resilience and pent-up emotion in this movie. It actually, like, this movie is almost all her. Even in comparison to White and to Red, which have a lot more plot, Blue is very much focused on how will Julie deal with her freedom, and it's scene after scene of her meeting other people, being alone, being interactive with other people, but a lot of silence and a lot of just her taking things in. It's a very, very coiled and emotional and to a certain extent cold performance, would you say?
Oh yeah, I mean, blue is also not the warmest color. I don't know if anyone's ever noticed this. It's actually quite chilly. And so yeah, it is the chilliest of the films. But that's because it's a film that's about mourning. It's a film about loss. Like, it's a film about, you know, liberté, but it's about having the rug pulled from under your feet.
What are some of the immediate things she does? She makes certain decisions. She's not going to speak to a journalist. There are journalists who want to interview the grieving widow about her dead composer husband and ask really, you know, untactful questions.
Yeah, like, is it true you wrote all the music?
And she basically tells the journalist to fuck off.
Yeah.
Vous avez changé. Avant, vous n'étiez pas si désagréable.
Vous n'êtes pas au courant? J'ai eu un accident de voiture, j'ai perdu ma fille et mon mari.
Julie, c'est vrai que vous écriviez la musique de votre mari?
But, you know, more drastically than that, she also sells everything they own.
Yeah. She goes to this kind of rambling farmhouse that they seem to have lived in.
Yeah, and decorated very decorously.
And there's only one thing that she saves. So she gets rid of all the furniture, save for one mattress.
Yeah.
And she saves a kind of crucial objet d'art.
Yeah, a blue lampshade. She saves it, but not without first damaging it, you may recall. Because this is the thing. She pulls it apart, or she pulls a fair amount of it off.
And it's not just any kind of lampshade, but it has these, like,
beautiful blue beads.
Translucent beads that hang. She also has a really interesting interaction with the housekeeper, who she seems to be sympathetic with. She encounters her in the kitchen, and the housekeeper is just weeping. And Julie says to her, "Why are you crying?" And the housekeeper says, "Because you're not." Mm. You know? So there's this sense of mystery around the widow Julie. Julie de Courcy, as she was known in her married life, but she starts to take on her maiden name, Julie Vignon. She's very clear about that at one point. There's a mystery which is like, is she sad? Has she grieved? What is she going to do now?
Yeah.
How can she live in the shadow of her husband's memory?
Yeah. Well, of course, what she does is she doesn't live in the shadow of his memory. She lives entirely in the present. As she moves house, she gets a new apartment. She tells her estate agent, "I want a building where there are no families."
Mm-hmm. No children.
No children.
She doesn't want any memories. I think at one point later, someone says something about memories. She says, "Memories are traps." She also...
That's so good, actually. I should tell myself that. Yeah.
Memories make you trapped inside your mind. Misty blue memories.
That's not staying in the podcast.
Oh, okay. I think I have the final say on that one. But anyway, in terms of music, it's interesting because we do see an early scene where she goes to visit her husband's, like, I guess it's like the archivist who's hung on to the score, the unfinished score of the concerto for the unification of Europe. And this is kind of the first time that we hear any bit of the score in the film. Julie looks at the handwritten pencil draft of the score, and as she's looking at it, we hear on the soundtrack the instrumentation and the music.
Yeah, as she runs her finger across it, which I think is absolutely marvelous.
Right, she runs her finger across it, but then it comes to a point where there's just a blank space.
Yeah.
But as she looks and listens at it, the music continues. And I mean, did you ever have any doubt that she had actually been the crucial person who, if she hadn't written the music herself, she had been such an important part of collaborating, of making this music happen?
No, I never doubted it.
She has this sense of the music that she hears in her head, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And There'll be moments where the screen kind of like
fades to black. Yeah, I love that.
It kind of blacks out, and then we'll like come back to the same moment, and that's often when the music is kind of swelling and she's hearing it, and it's like she's been suppressing this this overflowing emotion. So she actually takes that score and she disposes of it. She wants to destroy it. She wants no one to ever be able to find it again. She makes another drastic decision, which is her husband's like assistant or somebody, who's this kind of French Schlemiel guy named Olivier, who's not particularly memorable or attractive. She calls him to the house.
Mm-hmm.
He comes in the middle of the rain. It becomes clear that he's always been smitten with her. And what does she do?
She asks him to remove all his clothing.
Which he does.
Which he does. And then she stops him there and then on the mattress, which, I mean, having seen Hellraiser, I'm always very suspicious and frightened of just bare mattresses lying around.
Well, she does that, and then she just leaves him. She leaves him abandoned in this farmhouse, having made love to him one time, and then going off to live in her new life in her apartment in Paris.
Yeah.
Yeah? In some ways, the middle section of the movie, and most of the movies, is not overly driven by plot so much as it is by
incidents.
Scenes, incidents, yeah. And images. Can we just talk about some of our favorite moments? She moves into this new flat. She's going by her maiden name. She's hanging the dangling blue beads there.
So on one of her first nights there, she hears a fight on the street, and she looks out the window to see what's happening, and then she kind of goes out of her flat to, you know, maybe check out what's happening on the street, but not without forgetting that the door just locks itself when she leaves. And
sounds
so,
like you can relate to that, the sort of thing you might do.
I've never actually done that, though.
But you fear it.
I fear it, yes. I fear lots of things.
Sean fears leaving the stove on and forgetting his keys.
Yeah, anytime the doorbell rings, I get terrified.
Yeah, you're a bit like Julie, actually, that kind of shuddering intensity.
No, I'm a bit like, I'm more like Julie Christie in Demon Seed.
That's exactly what I think of when I think of you. So she's locked out into the stairwell. She just has to sit there. And what does she see from the neighbors downstairs?
She sees a booty call happening with a young woman and a man who lives in the building.
Yeah. The implication is this woman who lives downstairs from her is kind of a loose woman.
Yeah.
Perhaps she's doing it for money, I'm not even sure.
Or perhaps she just likes sex, you know?
You know, perhaps the doorbell on that downstairs flat is marked French.
Yeah.
Of course.
Or, you know, the doorbell is definitely in French.
Yes, yes. Okay, so later on, another neighbor comes to the door and says, "Hi there, you must be the new neighbor, Julie. We are trying to create a petition to say that there shouldn't be any loose women in this building." Clearly referencing this other neighbor that she's seen, and she refuses to sign it.
So I don't know who she is, she hasn't done anything to me, so no, I won't sign it.
She's this kind of independent-minded person who kind of wants to be a self-contained entity. She's kind of like a libertarian, actually, now that I think of liberté, right? It's like, I will do no harm to anyone else, I will not do any good for anyone else, I will be an individual, unconnected to anyone. I'm starting from a blank slate. I feel that's kind of where she's at this point of the film, right?
Mm.
She doesn't want any human connections with anybody.
Yeah.
And any sense of connection that comes through. Like, she actually is in the cafe, and she having an affogato, very classy drink, and she looks out and
it's
there's
not a drink, it's a dessert.
Oh, it's a drink and a dessert. It's a bit of both. It's a marsupial.
I love an affogato.
I know, that's why I brought it up.
Mm-hmm.
So she observes a street busker outside, a flautist, who is actually playing a tune of her husband's, and the music is taking her back to the past, and she doesn't like that. But she gradually starts to get drawn into certain people's lives, right? First of all, she's visited by, do you remember, the boy who has witnessed the car crash.
Yes, so he says that he's been trying to get in touch with her for a very long time because he has something that belongs to her. They meet somewhere, which we think like is the Centre Pompidou, but we can't be sure. He reveals to her that he has the necklace, the cross, that was her dead child's. And he says, "I cannot keep this because this is not mine. I must return it to you."
He also happens to have heard her husband's last words.
Yeah.
Which is something like, "Now try coughing."
Now try coughing, yeah.
Now, I have to admit, she then kind of has a wry expression and explains this. And it took me, like, 24 hours later, it took Sean to explain to me why this was funny.
Well, this is actually taking about 20-something years for you to find out why it was funny. You know?
It's scatological humor, so obviously it's not the kind of thing
there's
that,
some
like,
things you don't get.
14-year-old Brian wouldn't get. Okay.
But I do find it funny, there are some jokes that you just don't get. Maybe it's a European thing you don't exactly have.
European jokes about shit. Okay. Do you want to just explain why now try coughing
so,
is the punchline?
So, like, this woman, we'll say a woman, it could be a man, this person has a terrible, terrible cough. It's always, always coughing, okay? And they go to their doctor and they say, I have this terrible cough and I cannot stop coughing and it's just impossible. And the doctor gives them medicine, they take it, and they say, I've given you the world's most powerful laxative. And they say, well, why have you given me this? And they say, the doctor says, well, now try coughing.
Now, when you explain it, it's good, but when I have to read it in subtitles while Juliette Binoche is explaining it in French, I got a bit lost, but I understand now. The coughing will...
Yeah, because if you cough, you'll just shit yourself, won't
okay,
you?
Okay, now it makes sense. And for some reason, this seems to be the last thing that her husband was talking about. It's his favorite joke, and he always tells it. And he was saying it while he was driving the car, and the boy has overheard this.
Yeah.
So Julie is quite troubled by this interaction. I don't think she takes the necklace. She leaves it with him.
She says, it's yours. It's your necklace.
She wants nothing to do with walking down memory lane.
And that's that, you know, when we're going through this in the podcast, like, it really kind of hammers home the idea that she refuses, point blank, to be sentimental about her loss whatsoever. Or she's going to grieve for it.
Yeah, she's not going to hang on to the talismans of her child and husband. She's not going to complete the concerto. She has no interaction with the guy who's the assistant. He is going on his own to try and complete the work of the concerto. She actually learns this by watching a television interview where he's saying, I will complete the concerto for the unification of Europe.
Yeah, but she thinks she's destroyed the only copy, but of course the archivist made a copy because the archivist predicted that she would do this, which I find actually probably the most astute interpretation of her behavior by anybody else in the film.
Mm. It's very interesting because, like, as we talk about it, and obviously it has this allegorical significance about Europe, it's like both looking back and looking forward, right?
Yeah.
It reminds me of Walter Benjamin's Angel of History, which was so important to Tony Kushner in Angels in America, right? Which is, of course, also subtitled Perestroika, where the Angel of History is being pushed forward while simultaneously looking back. So history is about being hurtled into the future while also being aware of what has come in the past.
Well, ideally, yes.
Yeah, well, and that's where Julie places herself. Like, she wants to exist totally in the present, but the past and the trauma and the secrets and the difficulty and the pain will not be ignored. In terms of the new people that she meets, she begins an interesting relationship with the aforementioned loose woman who lives downstairs, right? She comes up to Julie's flat and says, thank you so much for not signing that petition. You know, there's a bunch of busybodies in this building. And then she kind of starts walking around and looking at all of Julie's stuff and says, I had a very similar lampshade to that one. And she looks at her and she says, something must have happened to you because you're not the kind of woman
who gets dumped. That's a great line
as
well.
It's very interesting.
Isn't it?
And actually,
oh, French cinema, my God.
Well,
you know?
It's French-Polish cinema.
But European cinema.
Yeah.
You know?
So, that woman was very interesting. And her relationship with Julie, like, again, it's not as if any of this really has a strong driving motion of plot. It's not like they become, like, best buds, right? But she actually then does call Julie at a later point, distraught, right? And asks her to come to a strip club where she works.
Near La Pigalle.
And why is that?
Well, because in a moment, okay, where she's performing, she looks into the audience and sees her father there. Her biological father in the audience.
And this really, you know, upsets her.
Yeah, and, like, she knows it was her father because he had to get the 1102 train back to, I don't know, Versailles or somewhere.
This is just a tiny little incident, yeah? And she just kind of, the first person she thinks of to call about this is Julie. But she's really distraught, and it's interesting, again, it's like, I've chosen this new life of freedom. She says, I like stripping. I think probably everyone would like to do this if they could. That's what she says. But the past, in the presence of her father, like, comes and intrudes itself on this new life. I think it's really interesting. We don't see this, but we hear it. And it really has nothing to do with the Juliette Binoche plot, except for, sort of, thematically. The crux of the whole thing starts to come when she re-encounters the assistant composer, Olivier, who has done this television special where he says he's going to try to complete the concerto. So obviously a copy of the concerto still exists. She comes, she seeks him out, they meet up. He says, I did this and I did that special because I wanted you to respond. It was basically to try and get you out of your silence and your solitude. And he says, I wanted you to either say, I want or I don't want. You can't exist in this kind of ambiguity of just renouncing. You know, you have to either say yes or no, which is interesting, almost like a referendum.
Yeah.
Right? And the yes or no is, should I, Olivier, complete the concerto or will you?
Yeah. And what are the consequences of that?
Well, the interesting, I mean, I thought this was fascinating. He says, like, if I work on this concerto,
it will be inferior.
It will be inferior. Yeah. It will be clunky. It will be finished. It will be my music. If you do,
well, everyone will clearly know that you were the talent and not your husband.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
J'ai pensé toute la semaine. Cette musique peut être ma musique. Un peu lourde et maladroite, peut-être, mais ma musique. Ou la vôtre, mais alors il faudra le dire à tout le monde. Vous êtes toujours là?
Je suis là, oui. Vous avez raison.
And I think actually, you know, in some circumstances, somebody would be like, yeah, my husband's dead, I'll complete it, yes, it was me. But that doesn't gel with her idea of liberty, does it?
And also, like, I don't know, there's something about, like, owning up to the past. I don't know, it all seems to have a symbolic weight that's not, like, purely logical, but it's like, leaving this work unfinished is, like, not dealing with all the emotions that have been damaged in the past, right? In some ways, she is as much of a damaged person as Anna Barton in Damage. Around the same time that she's debating what to do about the symphony, she also seeks out the woman who was her husband's mistress, who is a lawyer who works at the courts. And when she goes there, we have a brief glimpse of the divorce case that the lawyer is arguing, which is the divorce of Julie Delpy from Zbigniew Zamakowski, which will become the
yeah, I love that.
White.
It's so great, isn't it?
Yeah, so blue connects to white, connects to red.
Yeah.
So we only get a snippet of that, but this woman, actually, the lawyer, is a significant person in Julie's life because not only was she the husband's mistress, but she is still pregnant with his baby that Julie didn't know about. She's faced with this choice. Finish the concerto, deal with this mistress, deal with the unfinished business. And she kind of, in a flurry of decisions, makes some choices.
Yeah, and those choices are that all the remaining money that she has from her husband, she basically puts into a fund for the new baby.
Mm-hmm.
She says, you know, this is yours, take it.
Including the country house.
Including the house. And that's so drastic.
It is drastic.
No, I was wondering at this point where her money comes from.
Well, I don't know. She probably gets royalties from all those wonderful operettas that he wrote.
You know, I was thinking to myself, only in the early 90s could someone actually have a huge farm just because they're a composer.
Yeah, or maybe only in France.
Yeah.
So then the movie kind of concludes with this gorgeous, symphonic, in all senses of the word, collage, right? Where she and the assistant orchestrate the final version of the concerto. We hear for the first time the chorus singing in Greek, and they're singing the words of St. Paul about faith, hope, and charity, or faith, hope, and love, caritas, the greatest of these is love. Those are the words sung in Greek for the unification of Europe. The music, which we've heard in dribs and drabs, has finally come in all its symphonic splendor.
Yeah.
We get this kind of burst of symphonic visuals as well, where we see all the different characters that Julie has interacted with in a kind of kaleidoscopic pan through, you know, all these different settings and places. And we get this idea of union. She's passed through the emotional difficulties and she's going to move on into the future, thinking about union, thinking about love, which is the word that keeps getting repeated in the chorus. There's still one particular mystery, which, to be honest, if you had asked me years ago, high school age Brian, what did you think of Blue when you saw it? I would have said to you, yeah, it was good, but why in the end was she having sex in a fish tank? And I still don't know.
Yeah, we watched.
Do you want to explain this?
Well, I'll try. I mean, we watched the very last segment before we started recording this. where it is doing that kaleidoscopic panoply through all the characters that have been there before. And Juliet is being made love to, you know, and she's been made love to in a way that you're very, you can tell very clearly that there's a plate of glass between her and the camera.
She's being pushed up against the glass.
Yeah, not actually being pushed, but, she's moving into it, you know what I mean?
Pressing herself.
Yeah, she's pressing into it, yeah.
And then it kind of pans upward and there's like seaweed.
Yeah, okay. You know, if it weren't for the seaweed, I would have been like, Brian, you're reading into this fish tank metaphor too much. She's not really in a fish tank. If anything, it's to do with the distance between her and the fact that we're watching her on a screen and she's pressed against the screen, okay?
Okay.
However, there's also seaweed there, which really confuses the whole thing.
I mean, I guess it's kind of an underwater theme throughout the whole movie, because obviously it's blue, she's buried under blue.
She swims
quite a lot and goes deep, deep under the water. I'm not even sure who she's making love with. I mean, I guess the idea is having exhumed this symphonic work, having dealt with the wreckage of the past, she can move on. Presumably she has a new lover, she has a new life, and they're into the fetish of fish tanks.
Fish tank play.
Yeah. Everybody loves a bit of water sports, you know? Yes. Yeah, and so having seen her mother, who we haven't mentioned, the woman who's the stripper, the boy, all these different people, the mistress who's having the baby, we see the sonogram, which is tinged with blue. The last shot is back to Juliette Binoche's iris and a tear kind of streaming down her face. Even as we move forward into the future, there is the pain of the past.
Oh my god, I love this film.
Do you love it?
No, I really love it. I mean, I can't believe it's taken me, you know, 10 years. I've mentioned in this podcast that T.G. Carr used to do Le Film on a Friday night. And
not to be confused with Le Divorce.
No, Le Film. Even though T.G. Carr was Television Gaelga, it did have a European film, European language film, every Friday night. I remember on one particular Friday, I had missed the first 40 minutes of Blue.
Uh-huh.
So I tuned in, and I'm kind of like, oh god, I haven't seen it, so I can't. I'm not dipping in.
Little did you know that it really doesn't have a plot, so you probably
that was back when I was naive, my salad days, and I had seen that segment before where she tears the lampshade down, and I thought, okay, that's it. Yeah, I'm going to tweet about Le Film after I'm finished this podcast.
Good. I'm glad you announced your tweet in advance for people who believe. Listening to the podcast after the tweet has been sent out into the world.
That's the beauty of time. I'm an angel being pushed forward while looking into the past, okay?
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
Last remarks. We've talked a lot about the film and its images, and Kieslowski is clearly a master of cinema. Zbigniew Preisner is a master of music. What about Juliette Binoche as its center?
She's just as a beautiful emotional wrecking ball, isn't she? You know, swinging. Not necessarily hitting anything, but swinging.
It's a fascinating performance because, unlike some later Juliette Binoche films where she has far more histrionic moments, she has far more dialogue. In The English Patient, she delivers emotional lines. In Sils Maria, or even Let the Sun Shine In, she has, you know, bursts of tears and anger. Mm-hmm. In Blue, she's very, very contained and very internal.
Yeah.
The movie really rests a lot on her face and her kind of statuesque quality.
Yes, but the movie also is determined by the choices that she makes, you know, and not necessarily the reactions that she has.
It's all
very active, really.
It's what's going on behind her eyes. Yeah. I remember Roger Ebert writing about the mystery behind the eyes of Juliette Binoche.
Which is interesting because I don't think that quality has remained with her as she's gotten older. But that is not a detraction at all.
No, if anything, she's become a more emotionally open person. She wears her emotions as a middle-aged woman on her sleeve, and she somehow feels more relatable, whereas in these early films she is kind of chilly and distant. I mean, that's definitely true of Anna Barton in Damage, and it's true here. Even though we sympathize with her, actually an image and a shot we haven't talked about and maybe is the one that's most painful for me. Do you remember when she runs her hand, her knuckles, along a
dry stone wall
and just cuts them open?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we don't really ever see her cry for her husband and her daughter, but it's that image of the kind of torture that she's inflicting on herself. And then we later see her bruised knuckles. That
Red Raw
is kind of how we feel Julie's pain. We also didn't mention your favorite creatures in the film, the rats.
Oh yeah, so there's a
Les
scene.
Ratons.
The souris.
Souris is mice. There was a debate as to whether these were mice.
Well, that
or
was a rat. It was
okay. You say it was a rat, but the subtitles told me that they were mice.
Okay, mice are really small. I know what a rat's tail looks like. Okay?
These are newborn.
Yeah, no,
rats.
But there was a mother rat. We see
there's
the mother,
a mother rat, and then there's tiny little pink rat babies.
Yeah. So there's a scene where she finds a shredded cardboard box. Anyone who's anyone knows what a shredded cardboard box looks like when it's been eaten by rats. Okay. Anyone is anyone, darling.
You were horrified by this baby.
I was horrified, but I was fascinated. You know what I mean? Because the infants of vermin are vulnerable, but they're also repugnant, and they're still disease carriers.
And she's living alone in this flat. She has to borrow the neighbor's cat to deal with the rats.
You know, and that's a symbol of getting someone to help you.
Needing to rely on others, not trying to go it alone. Yeah, I alone can fix it.
Yeah, that's the libertarian attitude that's crumbling before your eyes.
Yeah, and it's interesting to ask as we move into 30 years on from the unification of Europe, where are we?
Yeah.
You know?
We're in murky waters.
Perhaps we're always asking the question of where do we go next?
Yeah.
Darling Sean, I have been staring into your deep blue eyes across the podcasting microphone, thinking that they would be a fitting complement to Kieslowski's cinematography.
I do have blue eyes, it's true.
It's true. Two big blue thumbs up, eh?
Yep, I've got blue balls for this film.
We won't have big thumbs up for the next Juliette Binoche installment, but we hope you will enjoy us taking down a film that is meant to be very, very sweet, and which we consider to be quite sour.
Yes.
We're going to give Juliette Binoche her due with two more installments. If you'd like to know what they are, of course, you can always find us teasing them at Broad Appeal Pod.
And don't forget to check out our individual Twitter pages. I'm at Sean McGovern X, and Brian is at BA Mullen Speaks.
You have a wonderful chance to tell us how much you like us, you really, really like us, by leaving a rating or a review at Apple Podcasts or any other podcatcher of your choice, Stitcher, all those other ones. We'll be back very soon. Fret not, we are not leaving you at liberté, but we will be in fraternité with you. Two more installments left. See you soon.
Bye.